This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The worst mistake that National Public Radio ever made was to turn down the offer to become the national distributor for a funny little show from Minnesota. A Prairie Home Companion has since gone on to enjoy some success. Its creator and host, Garrison Keillor, also wrote for The New Yorker magazine for 25 years, published collections of his writing, and last year starred in Robert Altman's movie version of A Prairie Home Companion. He also hosts the Writer's Almanac weekday mornings on many public radio stations, and he's now out with a new novel of Lake Wobegon called Pontoon. Garrison Keillor joins us in just a moment. Later in the program, David Sanger of The New York Times, who reports that the target Israel attacked in Syria this summer was the construction site of a nuclear power plant that might have been the embryo of a Syrian nuclear weapons program. But first, if you have questions for Garrison Keillor about his writing or his broadcasting, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Garrison Keillor joins us today from the studios of member station WYPR in Baltimore, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. Good to be here.
A lot of us return to Lake Wobegon every Saturday evening or read about it from time to time in one of your books. How much of your imagination does this place occupy?
Well, it keeps coming back to me in time for the show on Saturday.
It better, yeah.
I don't think about it a lot on Monday, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, but believe me, by Thursdays, Neil, I'm back there, heading that direction anyway.
There's a famous map of Lake Wobegon. Part of it appears on the cover of your new book, Pontoon, and it features such landmarks as Ralph's Grocery and Our Lady of Perpetual Responsibility and, the Sons of Canute Temple. Do you have to have that map up on your wall to make reference to it from time to time?
That's a fanciful map, Neil. It's a map drawn by somebody who hadn't been back there for a long, long time. And their memory has blurred somewhat. But it's good enough. It's good enough for now. No, I don't use a map. I don't aim for consistency. I just aim to stay a couple steps ahead of the search party.
It's not easy to do sometimes.
No.
Life as a celebrity is not so easy.
I was hoping you would tell me about that. What is that like to be the host of Talk of the Nation?
Well, the hordes of admirers are difficult to put up with sometimes.
We chose the right business, radio. It's
yeah.
It's a way to get up very close to people and to talk to them very directly, and they remember what we say. But there's none of that other nonsense, you know, the photographs and the standing around waiting for them to reset the lights.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to do all that.
Well, then you went ahead and made the terrible mistake of being in that movie, so now everybody knows what you look like.
I didn't know I was going to be in it. I thought they were going to get George Clooney. That's what they told me.
You were just his stand-in while they were waiting.
He was busy.
Yeah.
I don't know what he was doing. It was his big chance.
It must have been a remarkable moment when someone on the level of Robert Altman, the great director, this regrettably turned out to be his last film, but someone of that caliber decides to make a movie of your creation.
Hey, come on. What do you mean, a person of that caliber? Come on, give me a break. He was looking for work. Robert Altman has done all kinds of movies. He was a guy who worked steadily. And when he didn't get big offers from the studios, he was not above going out and directing television. Robert Altman, if he had wanted to do it, might have come and been on your show. You know, if he had his afternoon free.
He was a guy who
worked. He never intended to retire. He aimed to die in the saddle, and that's what he did. He was working on his next movie. He was almost about to go into production when he went to the hospital out there in Malibu, and he went in on a Friday, I think, and he died on a Sunday.
You were talking about the ability that we have to talk so intimately to people on the radio. It's been a long time, I guess, since families gathered around the wireless. We tend to talk to people, hundreds of thousands of them, one at a time. I grew up, I suspect, as I know you did, listening to the radio under the covers late at night when my parents thought I was asleep or doing something important like studying. And in fact, I made a radio from one of those kits I got as a present when I was, 8 or 9 years old. But I made it so badly that I couldn't listen to the radio stations that I used to listen to down on the lower end of the dial. And I had to switch to stations up at the upper end of the dial. And I discovered, I guess, the last days of network radio at night, which were on ABC at 77 in New York. And they were still broadcasting, I think, Tuesday nights, the old-style radio programs for the 1940s and 50s.
So you missed out on the whole lower end of the AM dial?
I did, for years.
You never got to listen to the Grand Ole Opry, which was down at 630 from WSM.
WSM could barely punch its way up into the New York metropolitan area. It had a difficulty getting that far.
Uh-huh. Okay, so did you get KDKA from Pittsburgh?
Every once in a while, absolutely. And you could get Detroit. Just last night, in fact, we were listening to Toronto, Canada, as we were driving down I-95 from New York down to the Washington, D.C. area.
And now they get it all on streaming on the web.
Yeah,
whatever happened to
the AM bounce, yeah.
Yeah, I have no idea. I was not smart enough to have made a radio from a kit, but I did listen to it under the covers, and those vacuum tubes gave off a lot of heat.
Certainly did. On a winter's evening, they were quite welcome.
I associate radio with heat ever since.
We're talking with Garrison Keillor. His new novel is called Pontoon. It's a novel of Lake Wobegon, one of several he's written. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Let's begin with Gigi. Gigi's calling us from El Cerrito in California.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Garrison.
Yes, Gigi.
Yes, this is Gigi. I'm a Chinese immigrant. I came here in 1971 as a student, and I studied in Syracuse. And after that, I stayed here, married, and had family. In 1980, I moved to Kentucky, Lexington, Kentucky. That's the first time I found your program. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you, it's a life-changing event for me, because when I was in Lexington, I felt I'm such an oddball in the whole community. Mm-hmm. And then when I found your program, I was so amazed that the feeling you talk about, the story you shared, I can identify with the feeling. That's exactly how I felt, and I can identify all the story that you talk about, even with my own background, my Chinese culture. I can identify every single one of them.
And I come from dark people, Gigi. So Chinese people are dark people? They have a sense of foreboding and a superstition that if you should admit to good luck or success, this may bring on evil. Is this?
I was so thrilled. It's so comforting. Then I said, I am a true American because Garrison Keillor talk about me all the time. I'm a true American.
You might be a truer American than people who were born here, Gigi. America is an idea, Gigi, and the fact that that a person may have lived here all of their life doesn't mean they get the idea. You know what I mean?
I see what you mean. Exactly.
Yeah. And you have a beautiful voice, by the way. You ought to be in radio.
We have enough competition already. Thank you, Mr. Keillor.
Thank you. Yes,
All right. Gigi, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Of course.
Thank you, Gigi.
Bye.
Goodbye. Let's get now to, this is Bob. Bob's with us from Chattanooga in Tennessee.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead, please.
Mr. Keillor, I was wondering if you could comment on a trend that seems to be going on with writers and producers and comedians who can't seem to write anymore without foul language or profanity, and why that might be now.
I don't know. I don't have enough familiarity with cable television, which is what I think you're talking about. Cable television, which is much more open to that than broadcast television.
Movies of today seem to. I can't imagine everybody in California speaks like that. in there? I'm sure.
I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with movies. As I get older, I'm 65 now. I really have backed off almost completely from what little bit of mild profanity I might once have used, and I might once have considered it daring, but the people I'm describing don't really use that kind of language. I'm not sanctimonious about it. I don't think that you could write tell a story believably about young people in big cities without using that language. But those aren't my subjects.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. You bet.
Thanks very much for the call, Rob. Let's see if we can get Mark on the line. And Mark's with us from Salt Lake City in Utah.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I lived in Minnesota, Northfield, grew up there, and now I live in Utah. And many times when I hear you talk about Lake Wobegon, I just substitute Mormon for Lutheran. And, you know, it fits here just as much. It would be great to have someone like you write about our culture here as well.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
I read your columns, and they tend to be much more overtly political than your references on the Lake Wobegon. I particularly remember one that you gave about 15 years ago during the first Gulf War about, if I were a prophet, this is what I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really meaningful, but relatively veiled references. I was wondering, do you try and be a little bit more subtle in your references to political stance on the air as opposed to your written editorials?
I don't really take political stands on the air. I don't think it's my place to. And if I ever did, or if I was ever leaning in that direction, I certainly have pulled way back from that now. I don't think it has a place on a Prairie Home Companion. We do political comedy, partly because we have an actor on the show who does a really good George W. Bush and also does a really good Al Gore. So last week we were able to have Al Gore sort of going back and forth with George Bush. But the column is political because I think newspapers need opinion and strong opinion. You're not supposed to hold your cards too close to your chest there.
Thanks very much for the call, Mark. We're going to continue talking with Garrison Keillor about his novels, about radio, and about poetry. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking this hour with Garrison Keillor. His new book is called Pontoon. It's a novel of Lake Wobegon. Here's an email we got from Patricia in Santa Rosa, California. I love the radio program, of course, but want to thank you especially for your column, which we are sometimes lucky enough to get in our Sunday paper, The Press Democrat in Santa Rosa, California. It's like sitting and rocking on the front porch with someone you can trust. So, Garrison, you've devoted an awful lot of time and energy in your life to two media, which we're told are going the way of the printing press and the lithograph, radio and newspapers.
Well, radio's not going that way at all. I think the Internet has been nothing but good for radio, and it gives these great shows on National Public Radio, ATC and your show and Ira Glass and Terry Gross and all these shows. It gives them a much wider cast. So I think radio has a very bright future. The newspaper, I'm worried about. I don't know how to live without them,
mm-hmm.
and you know, there are certainly signs that they are diminishing. I doubt that they're going to entirely fade away. But
yeah.
I love newspapers, and I can't start the day without picking up the national edition of the Times, which lands on my porch in St. Paul. I can't imagine it.
I also have difficulty. I have a very good memory, but if I read something on a computer screen, I don't remember it any near as well as I do as if I read it in ink on a piece of paper, or especially in a newspaper.
I think you can deal much better with the newspaper in your hands, and turning the pages swiftly, you are able to quickly establish that there is really no news today, and and so you can go for a walk. And it takes you a long time, you know, moving from page to page on a computer and scrolling around and hitting icons and waiting for things to download, for you to establish that there is no news today.
Hmm. It's been written that your creation, Lake Wobegon, is now in imaginary places in America, maybe with the Spoon River and other places that various people have created in their minds. And I wonder, do you think that people years from now will still be visiting Lake Wobegon?
I don't think so. I don't know, of course. I think that it's part of a larger nameless mythology of the Midwest, which I hope people will still be visiting years from now. I think that they will. People on the coasts sometimes seem a little unfamiliar with us. That's fine. That's mm-hmm. fine. We understand that. But I'm a northern plains prairie person, and I hope we have at least as long a future as the rest of the country.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Steve. Steve with us from Eaton, Indiana.
Yes. Yeah, I wanted to call and let you know I love the show Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
And I would wish sometimes you would say something about the artist of the music you play during your transitions on the radio. It's great music. And we wanted to say to Mr. Keeler, we definitely love the Prairie Home Companion, everything he does for the folk music and that stuff. And we appreciate the fact that I've been introduced to artists like Pat Donahue and Karen Casey on your show.
All right.
All right. Too thank great. You now.
Too great. Okay. A great picker and a great singer.
And if you're curious about the music that we play on this program, you can find those listed on our website at npr.org/talkofthenation.
So that'll be great. I appreciate it.
Gwen Oaten, our director, takes great pride in a lot of work picking out
yes,
that music.
Yes, it is. So. I love it. I appreciate it.
And the reason it's good is because I have nothing to do with it.
All right. Mm-hmm. Thanks for taking my call.
All right. Thanks very much, Steve.
Bye-bye.
Here's an email from Elias. How do you maintain your voice? It's awesome.
How do I maintain it? I don't know. What does one do? I drink coffee. I drink a lot of coffee. I stopped smoking about 25 years ago. And except for what I do on the radio, I'm mostly dead silent. So that's the answer.
Do you find that your voice sometimes is difficult to get back on your old familiar note if you've been away from the radio for, you know, a couple of 3 weeks?
No, slip slides around. I sing bass ever so often in a gospel quartet, and sometimes the bass notes are missing. I always have them early in the morning, and sometimes I wish the show were done early in the morning. But mm-hmm. I don't think about it. I never had vocal lessons, and so I never came under the instruction of a neurotic vocal coach. And never was made neurotic about the voice. It's what comes out of your mouth.
You started out in radio, as I've read, as a college student there in Minnesota.
I started out doing a newscast, Neil Conan, at noon on a closed-circuit radio station at the University of Minnesota. Worked hard editing teletype copy from AP teletype that was in the closet and worked hard and did a beautiful imitation of Edward R. Murrow. Really had Murrow's voice down, I felt. And then discovered towards the end of the school year that the engineers who were busy building a magnificent control room for us had neglected to do maintenance on the transmitter, and we had been off the air all year. I had done a daily 15-minute newscast, put my heart and soul into it, and I had been talking to myself. And that's when I got out of the news business, Mr. Conan.
Well, we've all done broadcasts like that. I've done some of them actually on the radio, but it's another story altogether. You were also, I've read, one of your ambitions in life was to be a writer for the New Yorker magazine, a magazine not popular in your home when you were a child.
It hit me hard. I was 13 years old, and my 8th grade English teacher, Frain Anderson, gave me a copy of the magazine. He said, I thought you'd like this. I opened it up, and here was a story by, I'm trying to think, E.B. White was in it, and John Cheever and A.J. Liebling, who became
pretty good lineup,
three
yeah.
permanent pleasures, especially Liebling, who mm-hmm. was unlike anything you'd ever read in Minnesota. He was just the jazziest writer. I go back to A.J. Liebling every year, and I pick up The Earl of Louisiana or The Sweet Science or one of his great books about France, and oh, he was just a magnificent writer.
I love The Telephone Booth Indian.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's got one of the great phrases I quote all the time, which is, like any coward, I read the newspaper from back to front.
He never really got the attention that he deserved. He was hoping for it. He was longing for it, but it never came to him until after he died.
You wrote for the New Yorker for 25 years. You've now taken this radio program that started locally in Minnesota, and it's become world famous, and it's available to anybody who wants to click onto a computer, as you suggested, anywhere around the world. You're now 65 years old. Have you achieved your ambitions?
No, I haven't. I still don't have any. I don't have any feelings of success. I sometimes have a little feeling of pride if I look at a page in a book or something and you know, I find a sentence that I really liked. But I don't think there's any sense of success with radio. And that's a trial when you start out. You long for some sense of completion or something. But then you realize this is a blessing, really, not to feel successful. You are always looking toward the next show. The past doesn't really exist in radio. We don't sit around and listen to, you know, our old stuff. We just keep moving on. Mm-hmm. And this is a good way of life. Without really knowing what we were doing, we stumbled onto a great way of life. And I feel more and more grateful for it.
Yeah, the reward is, as I've said from time to time, the reward for doing a good show and the penalty for doing a bad one are exactly the same. You have to do it again tomorrow.
Exactly. I mean, it's a great life. What we were looking for was not acclaim or a feeling of satisfaction. We were looking for intensity. Hmm. Was what we wanted. You know, you're a teenager. You're lounging around, and what you really want is intensity. And radio, especially doing a live show like yours or mine, is intense. It really is intense, and you live those days fully, sometimes too full. But
you're confessing that the man from Lake Wobegon, Mr. Laidback America, is an adrenaline junkie.
Well, it's only so excited that I can get, you know, my range is not great, but it's a beautiful day, Saturday, and it's really intense. We keep rewriting and revising and rehearsing and you know, we come up towards broadcast time and the show is much too long as we're adding up all the little separate numbers and where are you going to put everything and you know, we have this marvelous crew which you know, does all the hard work, the technical work and setting up all the stuff, but it's exciting right up to the end of the show, and then you take a deep breath and then you start to think about next week.
Let's get Julie on the line. Julie with us from Cleveland, Tennessee.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I had a question for Mr. Keeler.
Go ahead.
I was wondering, do you have a script for your monologue, or do you make it up as you go along?
Well, a little bit of both, Julie. I have sat down on a show Saturday, and I write out as much as I possibly can on a computer, and if I get five single-spaced pages of notes, then I feel really secure. I put it in as much order as I can, but I know that it's not going to come out that way when I do the story. The whole theory is that you will remember what you have written that day, especially the good parts, and so you just launch into it without a script there, and you don't bother to memorize it. You just launch into it, and it's sort of a little seance, and you count on the fact that the best of what you did that morning is going to come back to you. And it works. It really does work. And it just is much more satisfying than if you were to write a script And then you'd stand out there reading it, and as you read it, you'd be dissatisfied with it.
Hmm. Is there a clock that you're reading to? You know the segment is supposed to be so and so long?
I sort of have an idea, but I think the 20 minutes, the approximate feel of 15, 20 minutes is kind of embedded in my reptilian brain somewhere. But there is a clock on the stage. I can come back and look at it, and sometimes I've come back and looked at it and have been astonished. I've gone on towards 30 minutes, and that's terrible. A few times I have ended early and suddenly, and then I can hear the sounds of musicians galloping onto the stage from back wherever they were drinking their coffee.
Thanks,
that's
sir.
A lot of fun for me. That's a secret pleasure of doing the show, is making Pat Donahue, the guitarist, leap in from the wings.
Julie, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking with Garrison Keillor about his new book. Well, we're talking about him a lot of things. His new book is Pontoon, a novel of Lake Wobegon. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And a lot of people have seen your show there live as you do it, either in St. Paul or various tour stops around the country. But most people who've seen the show saw it in the movie version. How close is that to what they would see if they were there with you in the theater?
Not that close at all. Not particularly close. We tossed in some elements of the show, but I simply wanted to make a screenplay that would give Mr. Robert Altman a lot to choose from. I wanted to amuse my director, and I think I did. He had a great time shooting the movie, and he loved playing with the character of Guy Noir. Kevin Kline really enjoyed being Guy Noir and invented a lot of little physical business, mm-hmm. little Buster Keaton here, you know, little Stan Laurel there, and I brought in the cowboys, Dusty and Lefty, and Woody Harrelson and John C. Reilly played them, and they had a great time. So we tossed in elements of it here and there, and then sort of had a very loose storyline, you know, a story about evil mm-hmm. Defeating good. And good not caring.
A story about radio, clearly.
Yeah.
Let's see if we get one last call in. This is Gerald. Gerald's with us from Salt Lake City.
Yes. Mr. Keillor, it's wonderful to hear you being interviewed on the radio. I've listened to your show for lots of years, and I'm kind of disappointed because I thought Lake Wobegon was a real place. I've got your CD set, you know, the one where you talk about your sister and your niece and where you were a frog and all those kind of things, and I've always thought I was a frog, so you were kind of an inspiration to me.
Well, all right. My sister is a real person,
yeah, well,
I have a number of authentic nieces.
Wasn't your girl, your best friend, your nephew, a young lady that was in the CDs? Is all those real true stories, or is that make-believe?
Well, it's hard for me to tell, you know, at this point. I've come to the age where my childhood starts to seem like fiction to me. And Lake Wobegon is all pretty much an amalgam of my childhood. It's all a Minnesota, which is all past and gone. It's all back there in the dim mists. And
What kind of a creative process do you use to come up with places like Lake Wobegon or Guy Noir or all that? I mean, what process did you use to invent those people?
You get up early in the morning. That's what you do. You get up early, and you've just emerged from your dream life, which is occasionally very strange. You make yourself a cup of coffee, you sit in dim light, and these things just come to you out of the dark. They come winging out like fruit bats.
Gerald, thanks very much.
Well, you're a joy to listen to, and this is a great radio show, too, because they interview so many wonderful people, and I've enjoyed talking to you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
And thanks for the call, Gerald. I was in Minnesota not so long ago, and on the way to Morris, Minnesota, noticed a sign pointing to the Lake Wobegon Trail. What's that?
It's a section of the Great Northern Railway, which has been turned into a bicycle trail. It's really pretty. And it's a chance for people, especially in central Minnesota, to see their own countryside at a slow rate of speed. And it's very popular. It goes from St. Joseph all the way up to Sauk Center and beyond.
Garrison Keillor, thanks so much for being with us today, and good luck with your new book.
Bring your bike the next time you come to Minnesota.
I will. Garrison Keillor's new book is called Pontoon, a novel of Lake Wobegon. He joined us today from our member station in Baltimore, WYPR. Coming up, a mysterious air raid by Israel points to a nuclear weapons program in Syria and possibly nuclear proliferation by North Korea. What we know and what we don't. David Sanger of the New York Times will join us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.